From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Archer Mayer, who has just published his 30th Joe Gunther novel, Bomber's Moon, published by Minotaur Books. Archer Mayer, in addition to writing the New York Times bestselling Joe Gunther series, is a death investigator for the State Medical Examiner and has 25 years of experience as a firefighter and EMT. He lives near Brattleboro, Vermont. It is said a bright and clear bomber's moon is the best asset to finding one's target. But beware what you wish for. What you can see at night can also see you, often with dire consequences. In Bomber's Moon, two young women form the heart of the tale. One, an investigative reporter, the other, a private investigator. Uneasy allies from completely different walks of life, they work together, around and sometimes against, Joe Gunther and his VBI cops, in an attempt to connect the murders of a small-town drug dealer, a smart, engaging, fatally flawed thief, and the tangled political, increasingly dark goings-on at a prestigious prep school. While Gunther and the VBI set about solving the two murders, Sally Kravitz and Rachel Reiling combine their talents and resources to go where the police cannot, from working undercover at Thorndike Academy to having clandestine meetings with criminals for their insider's knowledge of Vermont's unexpectedly illicit underbelly. But there is a third element at work. A malevolent force, the common link in all this death and chaos, is hard at work, sowing mayhem to protect its ancient, vicious, very dark roots. When I spoke with Archer Mayer, I asked him how he was going to celebrate completing his 30th Joe Gunther novel. We started there and kept going. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Oh, absolutely not at all. I'm celebrating it only by writing the 31st.
All right, how far are you into that?
Good Lord, I probably am, five, six or three quarters. I never know when these things end. I generally reach the last page, realize I've run out of spit and go, oh, this is the last page. So it catches me by surprise on a regular basis, but I'm already, 260 pages into it, and I feel like I'm winding down. So I would probably suspect that I maybe have 20, 25 more pages to go, but maybe more, maybe fewer. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
So it's a good feeling anyhow, because I'm well within the schedule that I set myself for a yearly project.
Yeah. Now, when we spoke in 2008, we talked about the novel Chat, which had to do with like chat rooms and internet and computers. And I'm always just really impressed by how many fascinating situations you can put Joe and his colleagues in.
I'm sure he is,
like,
too.
Is it still easy to find plots, or was it ever? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. No, I mean, if you don't try to overachieve, and that's something. Here's the paradox. If you try not to overachieve, you'll find yourself subsumed by plenty. It's where you try to go completely crazy and say, I know, I'll have Arnold Schwarzenegger disguised as an alien spaceship commander taking over the U.S. Senate. And then you go, oh, no, hang on, that's already been done. And you just strangle yourself on the improbable nature of your and other people's imaginations, whereby if you choose from the get-go, as I did, to, in a sense, write about all the people around you and the events that happen on a daily basis, you probably would have to fall asleep at the wheel before you ran out of ideas.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you're just describing daily life, which is, I was about to say daily life, which is, filled with this kind of stuff. Well, it's probably, I hope it's not for most people like you or my wife or anybody else. But for people like me, who is otherwise occupied in some fairly exotic pursuits, death investigator, police officer, fire and rescue, that kind of stuff. This is pretty common fare, people stepping on each other, metaphorically and otherwise, and making damn poor decisions on an extraordinarily regular basis. So that's the world I describe as what Margot facetiously refers to as my people. You know, and I work with these guys, I see these guys, I pick up after these guys in a funny way, both as a cop and as an EMT firefighter and as a death investigator. I pick up garbage. That's society's description of what those jobs call for. There's nothing bad about that. It's a necessary, not even an evil. It's just an aspect of civilized living. Somebody has to walk at the tail end of the parade with a shovel and a wheelbarrow. And I'm one of a sort of a small group of people who do that.
Okay.
So for me to then extrapolate from what I see as a perfectly normal life and to make it up a little bit and try to turn it into proper English and write novels about it is a pretty natural extension.
Yeah.
So I virtually am never troubled for an idea.
Okay. Now, Bomber's Moon, people are saying this is the best Joe Gunther book yet. I mean, you've got blurbers. And actually, not even your blurbers. I mean, you know, some of the sort of reviews that you read online and like Goodreads and stuff, the people who got advanced review copies are saying they love your series, they follow you closely, and this is your best book yet. Do you agree? Do you think this is the best one?
Oh, good Lord, no. I would be the last to know. I haven't the slightest idea what it's like to read one of my books.
Oh, okay.
I write them. I know everything that got edited out of them. I know everything that I thought should be in them but didn't make it. In other words, I'm the guy who builds the houses. So I never get to live in the house, and I never get to step outside the house I'm building to go, oh, that's a nice-looking house.
Yeah.
By the time I'm done, you know, I've finished all the interior work and all the trim work and the paneling and the carpentry and the cabinet work and laying the floors and all the hidden nuts, bolts, and screws. And I finally dust off my carpenter's apron and wipe the, sawdust out of my eyes. And I walk out of the house and I don't look back.
Mm.
And people say, do you like that house? I went, well, I slammed my thumb with that hammer on the third floor. That hurt like
hell. I'm a little
like
sick
hell.
Of that house. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there is that aspect, too, because I try to build really good houses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one thing I absolutely hold myself to, because I know what it's like to be disrespected as a reader. And I'm if I'm going to be accused of that as a writer. So I bend over backwards, and I use a lot of people, including Margot, to help me edit these books. And therefore, between them, me, and the barnyard door, I edit each 300-page book, sometimes up to 15, 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of editing.
Yeah.
I guess I am sort of sick of it. And when people say, well, talk about this book, I'm sometimes very hard-pressed to even remember the bloody thing because, I'm writing another book, and then that's the book that I'm completely immersed in. So Bomber's Moon, I kind of struggle, and I go, oh, God, what was that about?
Well, I'm hopeful that I'll come up with specific enough questions that I'll bring it back to you.
Well, that'll be very helpful. Thank you.
Now, this summer you published, I'll call it a teaser, you published a short story called Crosscut. Is that an approach you're going to start taking with most of the novels?
No.
Just to kind of, no? No. How did that come to be?
That was a 30th anniversary thing and a little fun something to do. And you know, people are always saying, well, when are you going to write Joe Gunther the prequel? And I said, well, Joe Gunther is 103 years old, so, I I'm not sure I'm going to take a prequel. It'd be a really bad idea. I'm already in trouble enough when people say, how old is this guy? And I go, oh, come on. Every case is a month apart. So he's only 30 months older than when I began the series.
He's the same age as James Bond.
There you go. Or Travis McGee or Sherlock Holmes or any of the other people that curiously never seem to age.
Right. Now, I have a question. Several volumes back, you invented the Vermont Bureau of Investigation, the VBI. Why did you do that?
It was a matter, A, of convenience. I wanted to be able to traverse all of the state of Vermont without asking Mother May I.
Right.
So if it's a state unit, then the state unit can go anywhere in the state.
Sure.
If he's a Brattleboro unit, then he has to ask Mother May I every time he steps into some other guy's turf. And he has to say, as is indeed the case in factual Vermont, when I was a cop and I had a certain mandate, we don't call them jurisdictions because in Vermont you're a cop everywhere in Vermont, regardless of who pays your bills. But that having been said, when I went to Bennington on a case, for example, I would knock on the door of the Bennington PD or the state's attorney's office or whoever, and I'd say, hey, I'm in town. And they would say, you know, well, don't get yourself killed and call us in the morning. But it was a courtesy, and you had to go through the hoops and the protocols. Well, Joe Gunther could just do whatever he wants because he's got offices or sub-offices all through Vermont. So he's kind of like the state police. So Vermont Bureau of Investigation allowed me to do that.
Yeah.
I couldn't make him a member of the Vermont State Police, which would have been the obvious answer, because in order to begin there, you have to start as a trooper. And I was not going to take a 103-year-old man and make him a trooper.
know?
I mean, when I was a cop, I was already, you know, pretty old cop, and that was good. People didn't beat on me because they took pity on the guy with the white hair. So that was very useful as I quietly slipped the handcuffs on him.
So speaking of Mother May I, do you mind if I read a paragraph from the book?
Carry on.
Okay. There are rules to conducting private investigations. People think that if the client just wants information without intending to pursue any subsequent legal action, the PI can play a little fast and loose, maybe take a picture through the window of a private residence or access a computer or phone without permission in order to clinch a telling detail or two. In fact, the client's motives don't drive the investigator's behavior, or shouldn't. At best, it's her own integrity and respect for the law that holds sway. At worst, it's the fear that breaching such boundaries could result in arrest, the loss of a license, or jail time. I thought that was really, I loved that on a couple levels. First of all, I don't think that the actual rules get included in a lot of mysteries. And I also think that your background in crime and investigation, you know, helps us see a little bit of a truer picture of what's allowed. So I thought I would just start with that and also just ask if there are a lot of PIs in Vermont. I don't even know.
No, there aren't a terrific number of them, but there definitely are there. A lot of them are involved in defense mitigations cases and things like that, whereby, for example, someone's done something stupid and he is pulled in by the state's attorney and they're going to go in front of a judge and so a sentencing is eventually reached. And the defense attorney, everyone's agreed, they've either done a plea bargain, which is about 90% of the time, or whatever they've done. So now it's the only thing left for the defense attorney is to try to lessen the penalty that's going to be administered to his client. That attorney with suitable monies available, which can also come from the defender general, by the way, or the state of Vermont, but they can sometimes hire a private eye and say, look, let's see if we can mitigate, therefore this phrase, the penalty that's going to be brought upon my customer. You go out there, talk to his friends and family, the people who know him best, his employers, whatever, and let's get some good stories on him that had nothing to do with the case. Yes, he did what he did, but, you know, he stole his 30th car or something, but mm-hmm. let's find out. Yes, his grandmother, was dying of cancer, and her medical condition was such that she was between a rock and a hard place, and he was selling all these cars. Yes, he stole them, but he was selling the cars to pay for her medical care. Well, a police investigation wouldn't necessarily reveal that. It wouldn't have anything to do with the case, so it might or might not be discovered. But the private eye would discover it, and so there they all are standing in front of the judge, and the judge turns to the state's attorney and says, you know, what do you recommend? The state's attorney says, hang him high. The defense attorney says, well, Your Honor, my private investigator has some mitigating circumstances that might influence your wanting to throw away the key. Mm-hmm. So private eyes are heavily involved with that. They're heavily involved for insurance. You know, the typical thing of the guy, oh, I hurt my back, I can't come to work, and the private investigator has photographs of him playing golf. That's insurance fraud or whatever statute might have been. Well, that's not a criminal case. Cops aren't going to give a damn about that. But nevertheless, if the money is available, private eyes can be brought in as a kind of a legal parallel universe,
right?
And put to use. So a lot of private eyes are retired cops, which is curiously not hugely advantageous, because the rules governing private investigations are actually a hell of a lot tougher than the rules governing law enforcement. Law enforcement, you have a natural sense of power. You've got state's attorneys, you've got the state behind you, you've got these rules and regulations that are all laid out, but you also have a lot more leeway in how that's used. Just stepping into a room in full uniform has an influence. If you're a private investigator, you funnily enough, in the state of Vermont, private investigators are just about the only people who have to get a license to carry a gun.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Otherwise, anybody can carry a gun.
Right.
But if you have a license to be a private investigator, then you can't carry a gun. You have to apply for one and be looked at very carefully and whatnot. So,
isn't that ironic?
Cops can do stuff that private investigators have to be very cautious about, or just don't do it on the chance that they might have stepped into the dirt somewhere and muddied their shoes. So it's an interesting occupation, and it's tough to do. Not an easy way to make a living. And I found that, therefore, interesting, and I found that a lot of people would go, I didn't know anything about all that. And that's one of the reasons I deal with these subjects book by book by book.
Yeah.
I've probably told you, I certainly have told others, that one of my primary motivations for writing books is ignorance. There's just so much I don't know.
Right.
And I think that if I find it out and I share it in a compelling, well-written, and interesting way, then my readers will be similarly enhanced as I was doing the research.
And now you have a PI in this book, Sally Kravitz.
I like Sally.
Yeah, I like a lot of your... they're not all like ancillary characters. They're pretty main, but Joe is your main guy. So you have Willie, Sammy, Lester, and now others like Sally and Rachel. Do you enjoy adding new characters to the team and to other teams? Is it just kind of fun?
Well, yes and no, funnily enough. Yes, because it's fresh blood and interesting perspectives, and it allows you to sort of stretch your legs a little bit and think to yourself, okay, so I have Sammy Martin. She's a woman. and she has a certain personality and she has certain character traits. And you thought to yourself, well, so now I've set her up and there she is. And gosh, I wish I could do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but Sammy would never do that. So the introduction of a new female character, go, oh, well, now I can do that because I got a new character. So that part's good.
Yeah.
The downside is that after a while, you feel like you're hurting just a room full of cats, because you're thinking, well, now I have my inner circle of 34 characters. I'm feeling more and more like Tolstoy all the time. Who's on first, what's on second, and sometimes it's hard. You're writing a book, and you go, holy smokes, I haven't even mentioned Joe Gunther yet, and it's chapter 15. So that's where the editing comes in. That's also where, people ask me about the writing game, and I sort of respond, the writing art and the painting art, the musical art, all these things that are, yes, dependent on a physical capability. You got to know how to write or type. You got to know how to mix your colors. You got to know how to play the piano. That's fine, and anybody can more or less do that. But then there's something inside. There's a, I guess that's what makes those occupations art versus just craft.
Yeah.
And after a while, you leave the craft area and you enter into art. And I used to eschew that. I used to think, no, I'm just a woodworker. Don't call me an artist. Because I thought it was pretentious until I began to understand that it's the inner voice. It's the sense of that metronome, that sense of balance, that sense of something in your head that you simply cannot define, much as you might try, as I'm doing now, to give words to. How do you write? Well, okay, you put together a plot, or you do this, you do that. But at some point while you're writing, in my case, I just have a sense of timing, of rhythm, and therefore, it's time for Sammy to do something. It's time for Rachel or Sally or Willie or Lester or Joe or all these guys. They know when to come on the stage. And I don't figure that out. I don't have an outline. I don't have a plan. I don't have anything. Mm-hmm. It's all in my head. Mm-hmm. And as I'm writing, I pause and I walk around, and when I sit down, I know how the next scene is going to start and who's going to play the dominant role in it. And somehow, at the end of the book, yes, I do a lot of editing, but I do very little changing of the sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
That comes out pretty much set.
Now, speaking of Sally, and you just mentioned a lot of names, one thing that I thought was wonderful in this book, and I wonder if you can speak to it, is that when Sally gets partnered up with Rachel in a kind of set of circumstances neither of them is in control of, but they get kind of pushed together. And there's a certain amount of tension as they begin to work together. And I wondered if you can talk about the value of creating that tension between characters who will eventually become a partnership or a team.
Well, I can't speak for other people and how they've led their life, but I'm a watchful fella. Mm. And in my travels, when I meet people, I'm careful. I'm very polite. I try to be very welcoming. I try to be generous and spontaneous and friendly. But behind that veneer, which is not false, it's genuine enough, because I think that's how people should deal with one another upon initial meeting. But you shouldn't also, what was it Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify? Well, in this way, it's meet but analyze.
Yeah.
And so I analyze. Now, I analyze because I'm a student of human nature. Okay, that's just my nature. And it's my nature for any number of complicated reasons. not least of which, I'm a writer. So that's what writers do. They press their noses up against the window and they look inside and they try to figure out not only what's going on, but why is it going on? So I look at body language. I look at facial expressions. I look at or listen to the tone of voice and study mannerisms of anybody and everybody I meet. And I sort of play 20 questions with myself. I did the same thing as a law enforcement investigator, and I do that even now as a death investigator when I'm interviewing people and whatnot. Why are you saying what you're saying? Why are you acting the way you're acting? Why are you even dressed the way you're dressed? What does that tell me about you or your circumstances or the situation? It all falls to analysis. And that, I think, has a great deal to do about why I have the people I have in my books and how I have them interact with each other. So in the case of Sally and Rachel, I delighted in the fact that they had different backgrounds, quite radical, that Sally's was pretty unusual, as is mine in a funny way. I mean, if you look at my resume, you kind of go, oh, well, you know, there he is. But being on the inside, I've actually had a variety of pretty quirky adventures, and they have formed me, and they have formed Sally. And it's funny that you take another person and you put them through the exact same set of circumstances, they're going to turn out completely different. Mm. So here you have Rachel with her background and training, and you have Sally with her background and training. They're both wonderful people. They're bright and engaging and ambitious and curious, but you sort of think, yeah, they could be really good pals. They could be significant others of some, you know, on an intellectual and emotional basis, but they got to get there. Mm-hmm. And especially Sally, who's, you know, sort of rough around the edges, upbringing is closer to mine, funnily enough. I don't really have much in common with Rachel, but I do have a lot in common with Sally. And she's going to be watchful. And she's also going to be sort of the dominant personality. She's going to be more sure of herself because she's had to be that from a very young age.
Right.
But she's not dominating. She is merely probably more self-possessed than Rachel is, who might have more self-doubt.
Okay.
And so it's interesting and fun because they're both youngsters that things can evolve and change. And it gave me more so than in the case of Sammy or Willie or any other characters, it gave me the opportunity for growth and for evolution. So Sammy and Rachel, you know, this could be the beginning of a wonderful friendship, as the end of Casablanca says. You know, that it's fun for me to watch as well as to describe and create. So I'm hopeful that they'll bring us interesting things in the future.
Yeah, yeah. Even though you're continuing to grow your cast of characters, they do interesting things. Now, this book, as ever, concerns murder as well. And as I was reading it, I wondered, how many people has he killed in the course of writing these books? Do you keep a body count?
No, I actually don't. I think I'm killing fewer than I used to. Yeah. But then I think actually it's probably a matter of hill and vale. There are... You know, the other question that came up early in the series was, will you stop being so brutal on Joe? And I realized I was beating the stink out of him in the early books. He was bleeding or bruised or wounded or smacked over the head or whatnot. And I thought, ooh, okay. So I remember writing one particular book, I can't remember which one, where no one laid a glove on him for the entirety of the book. And that was just so he could have some time to repair. So it's one of the few times I actually consciously paid attention to that. Generally, I just don't. You know, people die because of the darndest reasons. I've had people die in these books where one paragraph before it occurred, I didn't know that it would necessarily happen. And that's often the case, okay, you know, because obviously I spend an inordinate amount of time around death in my other capacities. I've dealt with more dead bodies than you could possibly imagine, or that any normal, sane person could possibly imagine. And so to me, it's utterly normal. And I just, it's a part of life. It's no different than the birthing, living process is the dying process. And so I see it as utterly normal and natural. And so as I write about these things, I know that the darndest things can appear out of nowhere and knock you flat on your keister, and that's the end of your life. And all you were doing was taking the garbage out or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So when I write, I don't necessarily put a huge amount of import on the fact that it's going to happen. I do put a fair amount of effort into the after effects because, of course, I also spend all that time with the survivors of someone's death. I mean, when you're dead, that's it. You don't actually care anymore. You're done.
Right.
But everyone else is left standing around wondering to do what do we do with the void? How did I feel about this person? My God, I wasn't expecting this tidal wave of emotions, and now here they are. Well, how am I going to comport myself? And that's of endless fascination to me, and it's always changeable. So I have knocked people off in these books to study that. I've also knocked a few people off in the books because they're just lousy people, I have also not knocked people off sometimes because they are lousy people, and sometimes lousy people get away with it. So I'm always a little bit playing the devil's advocate.
Now there's an aspect of this novel that made me think about how the Vermont setting has perhaps changed from the time of Bomber's Moon to, or from the time of Open Season to Bomber's Moon, and that is the Thorndike Academy. And, you know, I suppose there have always been private schools, but I think there are more of them now. And I just wondered, you know, has Vermont changed a lot that as you are working on these books, you see a difference from book to book in the landscape?
You know, well, starting with sort of the beginning of your question first, there in terms of private schools, I'm completely unaware of the. I actually didn't do a demographic of, you know, are private schools on the increase or decrease, or are they the same? I've always had, like most people's sense that, well, there are private schools out there. And, of course, you can rattle them off, you know, St. Paul's and Exeter and Deerfield and blah, blah, blah. In Vermont, there I don't know, three, four, five. The one I made up was totally made up, because, I don't want to cast aspersions at a institute that could probably hire a lawyer with their spare change and wipe me out. Why would I do that? That seems a really dumb career move. So I made up Thorndike. And I did so because I thought it would be sort of amusing and quirky. I mean, my God, who writes about private schools in light of a murder mystery? Nobody. So I thought it might be great fun to do that. And then I thought it might be great fun also to go into the history of this school. And as I did, I delighted in some of the murky. I personally have nothing against private schools, but this particular school, which is another reason I made it up out of whole cloth, was I just thought it might be amusing to to sort of stir this pot of privilege and self-serving muckitude, and create this end result, which I quite delighted in. I was fairly pleased with Thorndike and its and its horribleness. Yeah. But of course, I don't extend that out to other schools, and I don't think the book did either. It just took at this.
That.
It was just something that crossed my own mind, because you do want to be careful of that. You just because you know your bad guy is a tall blonde doesn't mean that all tall blondes are bad guys,
right.
And you want to be attentive to that, not because you're driven to be PC, but it's just that's true,
right.
And that's a fact of life, you know. So it was fun for me to step aside from Vermont, and to create this parallel universe that really had nothing to do with Vermont. Now,
yeah.
To your question about Vermont, the greater landscape that has probably evolved is me.
Okay.
Back in the early days of open season and borderlines and whatnot, I'm doing more exploration of a pre-internet, pre-urbanized Vermont, where the Northeast Kingdom was in those days held on high. I mean, the very phrase Northeast Kingdom, which features almost exclusively in the book Borderlines, which is the second in the series. Nowadays, people sort of rarely refer to the Northeast Kingdom. They talk about Burlington all the time. And indeed, 30% of the entire state's population is in and around the greater Burlington area, which
right.
is astonishing. You know, and when I was cutting my teeth as a firefighter EMT and whatnot, and we were going to trainings and conventions, we would meet anywhere. We would go to Bennington or we would go to Rutland for a state convention. That never happens anymore.
Hmm.
You always, always, always go to Burlington for your meetings because that's where everybody lives and that's where all the convention halls are. And, everyone just sort of says, okay, well, we'll have our annual do in Burlington. And for someone like me who lives in absolutely the farthest way from Burlington you can get without falling off the state, I always go, damn,
yeah.
I don't want to do that. God,
yeah.
That's 6 hours of driving, round trip. So,
well, I think the other thing about the Northeast Kingdom is now when people talk about it, 90% of that talk is about Hill Farmstead beer.
Well, yes. Well, there you go. Craft beer. What
right.
was that? That was nothing. I mean, we all drank Budweiser.
Right. Yeah.
And it was a distinctly different world. It was much more of a rural world. Now we're all cursing because our cell phones won't work here, there, or anywhere. Well, you know, you didn't even have a cell phone. And to this day, as you discovered when you tried to call me, I don't either. You know, I have a phone that's assigned to me by the medical examiner's office so that when I'm standing over a dead body, I turn it on. It's a flip phone, and I call the office.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's off.
Yeah.
And I watch Margot with her smartphone, and that bloody thing is going on. All day long.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wouldn't get close to something like that.
Yeah.
I want to think. I want to daydream. I want to read a book. I want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I represent a foot in both fields because Joe Gunther has a cell phone and his guys, you know, they're modernists and the DNA has been discovered and the forensic lab can now use 3D machines and like that Faro device that I describe in the first chapter of Bomber's Moon. Now, this is a wondrous machine to see at work. It just you cannot imagine how extraordinary it is to bring up a death investigation done 6 months earlier and you're in a dark room and you bring it up and there it is. And you know, just as I describe it in the book, you're like a fly on the wall. You can move around. You can look under things.
That's
you can
amazing.
Look on top of things. You can you sure say, did anyone look inside that closet? No, I didn't look inside the closet. Oh, well, let's bring up the Pharaoh image, and we'll look inside the closet, and there it is.
Yeah. Let's see. I wanted to, when I interviewed you in 2008, I believe you had just started publishing all your books, and this book is published by Minotaur. You still publish your backlist, is that true?
Yes.
So what happened to that whole plan?
It's still very much alive and well. Margo and I published the first 18 books because they went out of print and I got all the rights back.
Okay.
And New York publishers publish all the new books, and they'll keep doing so because now, of course, there is no reversion of rights in a way.
Right.
In that books become virtual. And in the old days, they didn't. They just went out of print. And
right.
It literally meant that, out of print, period. There's no books, no books. Now, if there are no books because they're not a little longer in print, well, they are available virtually as e-books. And so that possibility of not needing a warehouse and not needing a physical book in order to keep the property alive, that's a different world and than it used to be. And the publishers have opened up to that. So I probably will never get rights back to the newer books because of this this invention, this technological invention of e-books and electronic archiving.
Right.
But obviously there are rules of the road. If, let's say, they can't even sell e-books, there is a restriction on the number of books that you cannot sell. So if the publisher, for example, says, well, we haven't sold a single copy of your, 43rd book, so now we will revert it to you because it says in the contract that if we can't sell even electronic copies, then you get the right to get that book back. Well, okay, I'm just making stuff up at this point because that's fortunately not my state of affairs. The books are still selling, and thank goodness I got that first 18 back because now I get to call the shots. I get the audiobooks, I get the electronic books, I get the trade paperback books. They're all me. They're all mine.
Okay.
And that means that people in the writing business, usually, unless you're Stephen King, of course, but regular people like me, you look over your shoulder, you might see your last three books are still available and in print because publishers are very impatient. They have very high expectations for sales. They have very high overhead, and you either perform well or they deep six you. They put you in the closet. And fortunately, I've been able to avoid that. So almost 100% of my 30 books are available, and very, very few, if any, mid-list authors can make that claim.
Yeah.
And it was only because I saw that opportunity and seized it.
Yeah.
Well, it's part of the understanding that I had very, very early on that people say, oh, I know, I'm going to buy a secondhand typewriter and I'm going to be a writer. And I said, no, I already got the typewriter. I'm going to become a businessman who happens to be a writer.
Yeah.
Now, here's the trade-off. Is that Patterson, or whatever his name is, isn't that it? The guy who's a writing
James
machine?
Patterson.
Because him. Now, I don't know him personally. I don't read his books, so this is not, a barbed comment. But my understanding is that yes, he writes a lot of books. Yes, he also hires people to write a lot of books or co-authors books that he, at most edits, but he doesn't write them. Right. But his name is on the cover. So this guy's he is absolutely a capitalist businessman writing machine.
Yeah.
and that's different. I am going to give you the best writing of which I'm capable. You're going to not see me sweat, but you're going to know that I sweated because you're going to, I hope, read these books and go, wow, yeah, he really applied himself. He was not lazy. He was not careless. And he paid attention to what a reader most wants in a book, which is a well-told tale. My understanding is that Patterson has obviously his millions of fans, but nobody I know with true analytical skills says that he's a great writer.
Now, I will just mention that I think he has an imprint for young readers that has his name on it, but those authors get their credit as well.
I'm sure he shares everything. I have nothing against the guy.
Yeah.
I was merely describing different models.
Yeah, yeah.
So here are the three models that I was going for. Okay, the first model is the stars in your eyes. I'm going to be an artist, and everyone will flock to my door. Okay, so you write the great American novel. It's a cheesy piece of mess, and you've taken 15 years to write it. All your friends and family are tired of supporting you. And so you've written this book, but you're not making a living at it.
Right.
You know, you can call yourself a writer. You can also call yourself a blonde, even though it comes out of a bottle. I don't care. You know, it's not accurate. The middle category is myself. You're a journeyman writer who makes a living as a professional writer, and that's it. You know, not very sexy, but there it is. And the third category is the true carnivore, the king of the jungle. He goes out there. He may be a nice guy. He may share the credits and everything, but he absolutely, because of his business background, and I gather that Patterson came out of advertising world, but I may have that wrong, but he applied a business model to his career, and by God, he knocked him dead, you know, right out of the ballpark. And I'm not saying that he's a nasty guy or that he steals people's property.
No.
I'm sure he's helped a lot of people become co-authors and whatnot, but it's not my kind of writing. I need to bury myself in the lives of the characters, and to Patterson's credit, he may do that now and then with some chosen projects of his, but a lot of books that he turns out, he does, he encourages other people to write them for him. He edits a few. Call him a shepherd. But he's not my kind of writer, which is I write a book a year, and I spend all year long writing that book. Mm-hmm. It's just a different way of doing things. Do I occasionally curse my choice every once in a while when I see yet another reference to Patterson and his millions? You bet your bippy I wish I were as well off as he was. But, yeah, that just ain't in the cards, at least not at the moment.
That business model reminds me of the Tom Clancy books that kept coming out after he had passed away. You know,
I know. It's
there's
like,
a mechanism.
Did I miss that headline? Yes. Famous dead author reborn, right?
All right. So I have one last question for you, Archer. I always like to finish up by asking a question for listeners who are writers. And I wondered if you have advice for other writers about keeping a series fresh, both for you and your readers, which I think you've done. I don't know. Do you have any advice to that effect?
Well, they're obviously my brain is teeming with things, but what pops primarily into my head is that if you write a really good book and your editor says, by God, you did it, just do that again. You know, you hit your stride. My urging would be ignore that. Don't do it. If you did it once and you did it well, don't do it again. Do something different.
Okay.
Challenge yourself. Run the risk of failure. Get comfortable.
Oh, that sounds great.
Don't confuse confidence with self-confidence.
All right. That's wonderful advice. Thank you so much. I want to just mention again, the name of the 30th Joe Gunther novel is Bomber's Moon. Archer Mayer, thank you for speaking with me.
It's been a delight, Sheila. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author, Archer Mayer. You can learn more about his work at archermayer.com, and you can find a previous interview that I conducted with him on the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. Blue moon, new moon, harvest moon, now bomber's moon. This week's Write the Book prompt is to come up with a new type of moon, figure out a name for it, and write about a night on which it rises. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you look there, you'll also see a tab with a hashtag that tells you about my book giveaway. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.